through TechMeme this morning reports that Claude Access in China has developed a resale layer. Sites buying API tokens abroad, routing requests through what the report calls transfer stations, and selling the ability to use Anthropic's models back into a market where official access is constrained. That's a much more concrete story than another argument about whether frontier systems should be open or closed. Somebody wants the model, somebody else can get the token. A third party stands between them and turns that difference into a business.
The phrase transfer station carries an actual mechanism. The access boundary isn't only a policy page or a country list. It becomes a place in the middle of the transaction. The user isn't touching Anthropic in the normal account sense, but the request still wants to reach Claude, so the market invents a relay.
Right. And the reason I'd lead with this on a Sunday is that yesterday's braid was about Anthropic's managed access regime for Mythos, and Friday's broader story was model gates, government pressure, and release queues. I don't want to replay that whole chapter. The fresh piece today is what happens after the official channel narrows. Demand doesn't file a complaint and go home. It looks for a path.
The path gets awkward for everyone. For the lab, account control starts to look like a security boundary with a resale market attached. For regulators, blocking the official product may create less visibility rather than more control. For users, the model now comes through an extra party whose incentives aren't the lab's.
That last part matters. If you use Claude through a normal API account, the lab can at least attach behavior to an account, a billing identity, a country, and a policy regime. A transfer station site can break some of that linkage. Maybe it can log prompts. Maybe it can modify outputs. Maybe it can pool traffic from many users under one upstream identity. The report, as summarized by TechMeme, is about China and Claude Access specifically, so I'm keeping the scale and legality tied to that item. But the mechanism is portable. Restricted supply plus strong demand creates arbitrage, arbitrage.
It also makes the open weights debate less ceremonial. Ethan Mollick had two posts yesterday about open models, closed models, and the business structure around frontier intelligence. The practical version isn't just whether you believe in openness as a value. It's what happens when the model people want is useful enough that account access itself becomes a scarce good.
Mollick's point, as I read it from the posts in today's sources, is that open weights and closed frontier services solve different problems. Open weights give you portability, local control, and less dependency on one vendor's account decision. Closed systems, at least for now, still concentrate some of the highest capability behind a service interface. The Claude resale story puts those two facts in the same room. People can philosophically prefer open models and still root around a closed model gate because the closed model does the job they need today.
That's the uncomfortable split. Ideology says one thing, task pressure says another. And for a lot of users, especially outside the official distribution footprint, the choice may not feel like open versus closed. It may feel like working versus not working.
There's a policy trap here, too. If the lab says, we're restricting access because we have safety, compliance, or geopolitical obligations, that can be a serious position. But when unofficial access grows around it, the restriction may push some usage into channels with weaker auditability. The lab still has to comply. The user still wants the tool. The relay operator now has leverage.
And maybe the relay operator becomes a weird kind of shadow platform. It isn't a model lab, a normal reseller, or quite an app developer. It sells proximity to a model it doesn't control. That's a very modern AI business category, and it's also a very fragile one.
It's fragile because everyone upstream can change the rules. Anthropic can tighten account detection, rotate policy enforcement, change pricing, or cut off traffic patterns. Governments can target intermediaries. Users can move to a domestic model if the quality gap closes enough. But while the gap exists, transfer stations are a sign that model access is becoming more like payments, ad inventory, or cloud capacity than a normal software subscription. The account itself is inventory.
That also changes how I hear the word access. We use it as if it's binary, allowed or blocked. But this story is about degraded access, routed access, borrowed access, and commercially packaged access. It isn't the same as being a customer of record, but it may be enough to get the answer.
And enough is the dangerous word. Enough for a student, a coder, a small company trying to automate a workflow, or a broker trying to collect margin. The official policy can be coherent on paper and still create an unofficial user experience that's messier than the one it replaced.
The big labs are going to have to decide whether access policy is a compliance document or a product surface. Users experience it as a product surface. They hit a wall, a queue, a price, a country block, a capacity limit, or a degraded substitute. Then they decide how badly they want the capability.
That's a good way to say it. The product is partly the model and partly the path to the model. Today's Claude item is one reported example, not a universal map of the whole market, but it shows the next question after gated release. If you narrow the official path, who gets paid to build the unofficial one? The Financial Times, again through TechMeme, reports that Google told Meta around March that it couldn't provide all the Gemini capacity Meta wanted, and that this delayed some Meta AI projects. That's a deliciously strange buyer-seller relationship. Meta is one of the largest infrastructure companies in the world, and in this story, it's still downstream of somebody else's serving constraint.
It makes the word hyperscaler feel less absolute. You can own data centers, have enormous capital expenditure, hire model teams, and still need a competitor's model capacity for a specific project. The hierarchy isn't simply big company sells to small company. It's big company negotiating with big company over a scarce interface.
And the scarce interface here isn't just chips in a warehouse. It's Gemini capacity, model serving, scheduling, reliability, model availability, and whatever internal allocation Google has to do between its own products and external demand. The report doesn't say Google refused Meta out of strategy. The narrower fact is more interesting. Google couldn't offer all the capacity Meta wanted.
That's a much better sentence than the dramatic version. It says the system has constraints without pretending we know the motives. Google might have had product commitments, internal demand, technical limits, or commercial terms that didn't fit. But from Meta's side, the result is the same. The model you want sits behind another company's allocation machine.
CNBC's Alphabet piece from Saturday is useful next to this, because it focuses on Alphabet's custom tensor processing units. I'll expand that once. Tensor processing units are Google's in-house AI accelerators, and CNBC frames them as one of Alphabet's strongest weapons in the AI race. The usual read is cost and performance. Google can train and serve models on its own silicon rather than only buying NVIDIA GPUs at market prices.
But in the Meta story, the silicon also becomes a rationing system. Google's internal accelerator estate has to serve Search, Gemini, Workspace, cloud customers, internal research, and a would-be customer like Meta. Every scheduling decision becomes a commercial decision, whether anyone calls it that or not.
Exactly. And that puts Google in a position that's subtly different from the normal cloud provider position. If Amazon rents you GPUs, you may worry about price and availability. But Amazon usually isn't selling you the model behavior itself. With Gemini capacity, Google is selling access to a model system it also uses to compete. Meta wanting that capacity is a sign that the model layer can become an input, even for companies that are building their own.
It also says something about the pace of AI product work. If Meta wanted Gemini for some projects, that implies the fastest route wasn't necessarily waiting for internal parity or retraining a substitute. It was getting capacity from the company with the thing that worked.
And if the capacity wasn't there, projects moved slower. That's the operating consequence. Not a grand theory, a delay. Somebody's roadmap meets somebody else's cluster.
There's a related tech meme item today about skepticism toward orbital data centers and space-based AI infrastructure. I don't want to spend much time on that because the near-term story is sitting right here on Earth. The bottleneck isn't only whether you can imagine a more exotic data center. It's whether Google can spare enough model-serving capacity for Meta in March.
The orbital stuff can be fun to argue about. But today's hard edge is allocation. Who gets the model, for what workload, at what latency, and under whose commercial priority? And if even Meta can be told, no, not all of it, then smaller customers should assume the public model endpoint isn't just a technical API. It's a queue with a business model around it.
And maybe the queue is invisible until it fails to give you what you need. Cloud dependency tends to disappear when the demo is smooth. Capacity feels infinite right up until the provider says, not for this, not at that volume, and not on that schedule.
The Meta Google item pairs with the Claude Transfer Station item in one limited way. One is about account access and geography. The other is about capacity and corporate allocation. I don't want to force them into the same story, but both make model access feel less like downloading software and more like negotiating for a scarce service.
And scarce services produce intermediaries, priority lanes, resellers, internal fights, and weird contracts. That's a less glamorous picture of frontier AI than the model card, but it's probably closer to how the industry is going to feel for a while.
The point I'll carry forward from this segment is simple. When a company says it has a great model, the next question is how much of that model it can actually sell, to whom, and without delaying its own plans. The Wall Street Journal, through TechMeme, has a story today about Chinese models, including Z.AI's GLM 5.2, being discussed as matching U.S. models at finding security bugs. Today's sources also include a Reddit link pointing at the same journal story, and Mark Andreessen reacting to GLM 5.2 as a major competitor model. This is a cyber-specific update, not a general verdict that one whole model ecosystem has caught another.
That distinction matters because security-bug finding is a narrow but serious capability. A model can perform well on vulnerability discovery tasks and still differ a lot on agent reliability, tool use, long context behavior, refusal policy, multilingual performance, or cost. But cyber is one of the domains where narrow capability is enough to change the conversation.
The policy timing is what makes it interesting. The last few days have been full of Western access restrictions, model gates, and arguments about who should get frontier capability. Then today's China cluster says, meanwhile, comparable claims are being made outside the controlled channel, especially around security work.
And that puts export controls in their proper place. They're a lever. They can slow access to chips, cloud services, model accounts, or some pieces of the stack. They don't guarantee a permanent capability gap, especially not if the relevant task is something like finding bugs, where data, engineering discipline, benchmark targeting, and deployment practice all matter.
I'd be cautious with the strongest version of the claim. Matching U.S. models at finding security bugs doesn't automatically mean matching Anthropic or OpenAI across the whole frontier surface. It also doesn't tell us how the evaluation was built, what distribution of vulnerabilities it tested, or how the model behaves in a real defensive workflow with noisy code, permissions, triage, and patch review.
But it's enough to make the access control story less comforting. If the policy story says, we can keep advanced capability inside a trusted release channel, and the cyber story says, capable alternatives are emerging outside that channel, then the policy has to be judged by its actual effect, not by the neatness of the boundary.
There's also a cultural piece here. A lot of the public reaction to Chinese open or semi-open models swings between dismissal and panic. Neither is very useful. The better posture is to ask what the model is reportedly good at, what evidence supports that claim, what task distribution it covers, and how quickly independent users reproduce it.
Security is a good domain for that because the artifact can be checked. Did the model find a real bug? Was it already known? Did it produce an exploitable path? Did it suggest a patch? Did the patch break something else? You can turn a lot of the hype into concrete review steps.
And the recent OpenAI cyber model coverage from earlier this week gives this a little more edge. We talked on Monday about GPT 5.5 cyber and automated patching. If Western labs are productizing security models while Chinese labs are reported to be pressing on vulnerability discovery, then cyber becomes one of the places where model competition isn't abstract. It touches code bases, bug bounties, defense teams, and the offensive side too.
I keep coming back to the asymmetry of verification. A company can publish a benchmark claim quickly. Defenders have to decide whether to trust it, test it, or ignore it. Attackers can try it on real targets with less ceremony. That means even a partially true capability claim can affect behavior before the academic consensus catches up.
That's a good warning, and it stays within the evidence. The journal-linked item is enough to say Chinese cyber model capability claims deserve attention. It isn't enough to say the global AI race has reset, even though the Reddit headline uses that language. Reset is too much unless the evidence is broader than this.
And the Reddit post had no comments in the source snapshot, so it's sentiment and distribution, not primary evidence. The primary story is the journal item as surfaced by TechMeme. The background reaction tells us people are ready to slot it into a bigger geopolitical argument, sometimes faster than the details can support.
So the measured version is GLM-5.2, and related Chinese models are being discussed in serious venues as competitive on cyber tasks, and that sits next to Western efforts to restrict model access. Controls can still matter. The open question is whether they can keep up when capability is being reproduced, optimized, and served through other channels.
And the next useful evidence would be independent cyber evaluations that show the task mix, the breakages, and the cost of running the model in an actual security workflow. A chart saying matched is a start. A defender using it on a messy internal codebase tells you much more.
I'd leave this item there. No victory lap for any side. And no panic story. Policy is operating against a moving technical target. Perry Metzger posted Saturday night about AI being used to create a large machine-checkable formalization of a proof. The source summary doesn't give me the underlying proof details, and the XFetch tool wasn't available in this shell run, so I'm going to keep this at the level the source supports. The notable part isn't a generic claim that AI can do math. It's AI assistants producing a large formal artifact that a proof assistant can check.
That difference is huge. A natural language proof can be persuasive, elegant, incomplete, or wrong in ways that take expert reading to find. A machine-checkable formalization has to satisfy a much stricter interface. The proof assistant doesn't care if the explanation sounds plausible. It cares whether the terms line up.
And that changes the labor model. When people say AI helped with math, the phrase can mean a lot of things, suggesting lemmas, translating notation, searching for examples, writing explanatory prose, or doing symbolic manipulation. Formalization is different because the output isn't just advice to a mathematician. It's an artifact that can be checked by software.
It also creates a strangely honest collaboration. The model can be fluent, but the checker is unforgiving. If the formal object doesn't type check, if a lemma is missing, or if the dependency is wrong, the system stops. That's a better environment for AI assistants than domains where a smooth paragraph can hide the mistake.
There's a parallel to coding agents, but I don't want to flatten the two. In code, tests are usually partial. They tell you something about behavior, but they rarely prove the whole program. In formal proof, the checker can give you a stronger kind of yes for the formal statement you actually encoded. Of course, you can still formalize the wrong theorem or leave out the human meaning you thought you had captured.
That's the deliciously exact breakage. The machine can verify the artifact, but humans still have to decide whether the artifact corresponds to the mathematical claim they cared about. AI can help build the bridge, and the proof assistant can inspect the bolts, but somebody has to confirm it crosses the river they meant.
That metaphor earns one use because it points to the boundary. The technical interest here is that AI may be moving from conversational assistant toward formal artifact producer in domains where the validator is independent of the model. That's a healthier setup than asking the model to grade its own reasoning.
And it's a much more interesting story than AI replaces mathematicians. Formalization is hard and full of translation work between human insight and machine syntax. If AI makes more of that translation possible, then more math can become checkable. That doesn't remove taste, conjecture, or explanation. It changes what can be verified once the idea exists.
We still need the underlying thread or paper before saying more. The agenda explicitly told the writer to fetch the thread so the proof and AI role aren't overstated. The bridge refused the X tool in this environment, so I'm not going to invent the missing specifics. we can still place the item, a high signal capability note, because machine checkable output differs from chatty help.
And it fits the moment because a lot of AI progress now shows up as better coupling to external validators. Code has compilers and tests, math has proof assistants, security has reproducible bugs and patches. The model becomes more useful when the world around it can say no in a precise way.
The technical optimism here is pretty specific. The model isn't suddenly trustworthy in the abstract. It can produce more work inside systems where trust is earned by a checker, a test, or a reproducible artifact.
And the creative possibility is bigger than math. Any field with a hard verifier becomes a candidate for this kind of assistance. The model does the tedious search and translation. The verifier catches a lot of the nonsense. The human spends more time deciding which formal objects are worth making.
That's enough for today. Perry's post marks the item. The next step is the underlying artifact, the proof assistant involved, and a clearer account of how much of the formalization was AI-generated versus AI-assisted. Bloomberg, through TechMeme, has an item about AI becoming part of the 2026 U.S. midterms as public anger grows around data center expansion and industry funding. Al Jazeera, yesterday, has the more physical version. Arizona communities fighting data centers while water cuts loom. This overlaps with infrastructure coverage from earlier in the week, so I want to keep it as a fresh update rather than a whole new thesis.
The Arizona detail makes it concrete. A data center isn't just an abstract response to model demand. It's land, water, substations, cooling, tax incentives, jobs, noise, and a local government meeting where people have to decide whether the trade is acceptable.
And the midterms item says that conflict is becoming campaign material. If voters associate AI with data centers that consume local resources or change electricity and water planning, candidates will use that. The industry can talk about national competitiveness and model progress, but the county sees a facility, a permit, and a utility plan.
There's a tension there that the industry often explains badly. AI companies want the public to see intelligence, productivity, medicine, creativity, and national strength. Local residents may see a warehouse full of machines asking for power and water. Both views can be understandable at the same time.
That generosity is important. A town can oppose a data center without being anti-technology. A company can want to build one without being cartoonishly indifferent. The conflict comes from the fact that AI's benefits are often distributed nationally or globally, while some costs are negotiated locally.
And water makes that impossible to launder through software language. You can't tell someone worried about cuts that the future needs more inference and expect that to settle it. They will ask which aquifer, which ratepayer, which promise, and which enforcement mechanism.
That's why the politics lasts. Data center developers can promise jobs, tax revenue, and infrastructure investment. Opponents can point to resource stress, land use, and the feeling that local consent is being treated as a checkbox. Once that becomes part of elections, every new project inherits the last fight.
And the AI industry isn't used to being seen as a land use actor. Software companies are used to being argued about through privacy, speech, labor, monopoly, or safety. Data centers pull them into zoning, water rights, and utility planning. That's a different kind of politics.
It also changes the infrastructure conversation from how much compute can be financed to where compute can be tolerated. Capital may be available, chips may be available, but a project can still be slowed or blocked because the local water story is bad, the power story is bad, or the community doesn't believe the benefits will stay nearby.
There's a funny inversion here. The model feels like the most advanced object in the story, but the bottleneck can be very old. Water, land, permits, trust, and neighbors who don't want the bargain being offered.
And this loops back to the Meta-Google capacity story, only in the practical sense. Everyone wants more serving. More serving means more facilities somewhere. Somewhere has voters. Somewhere has water politics. So the capacity question eventually leaves the spreadsheet.
The Al Jazeera story is useful because it doesn't let the issue stay in the financial register. Water cuts aren't a metaphor. They're a daily life constraint. If AI infrastructure wants to grow in places already stressed by climate and development, the consent problem won't be solved by saying the models are important.
So the fresh update is this. AI infrastructure is becoming legible as local politics in the 2026 cycle. The companies that understand that will speak in permits, water commitments, utility upgrades, and enforceable local benefits, not only in national competitiveness.
And the companies that don't understand it will keep being surprised when the community meeting becomes the place where the future gets delayed.
A Hacker News item this morning points to an open OpenAI Codex issue, asking for a way to exclude sensitive files. The source summary says the discussion is around file permissions and containers as current workarounds. It's a small item with only a handful of points and comments in the snapshot, so I'm not going to inflate it into a broad incident.
But it's exactly the kind of small item that tells you where trust gets negotiated. A local coding agent is useful because it can read the repo, understand context, run commands, and make changes. The same access that makes it useful can put secrets, private notes, customer data, or production config within reach.
And people want a first-class exclusion mechanism because file permissions and containers are powerful, but not always ergonomic. If the mental model is, I can ask the coding agent to work in this repo, then the boundary should be visible at the same level as the task. Which files are off limits? Which directories are invisible? What happens if the agent tries to read them?
That last question matters. The system shouldn't just avoid sending a sensitive file by accident. It should make the refusal understandable. If an agent can't read an environment file, the user needs to know whether it was excluded by policy, unavailable because of permissions, or missing from the workspace.
The issue also sits next to a Reddit post in the source set about random organizations appearing on an OpenAI account. But that Reddit item is only background here. I wouldn't combine them into one account security story without verification. The Codex issue is enough on its own. Local agent tools need explicit file boundary controls.
And the boundary has to survive convenience pressure. Developers won't keep using a setup if every safe run requires a bespoke container ritual. They will eventually point the tool at the real repo because that's where the work is. The product has to make the safer path feel normal.
There's a deeper design question here. Should exclusion live in the repo, like a checked-in policy file? Should it live in the user's machine config because secrets and personal notes are local? Should it follow the session because one task may need access that another task shouldn't have? Different answers create different breakages.
Repo policy is shareable, but it can expose the existence of sensitive paths. Machine policy is private, but it may not travel with the project. Session policy is flexible, but people forget what they allowed 3 commands ago. None of those are perfect. That's why users are asking for something clearer than vibes and shell discipline.
And because this is Codex, the issue has an extra resonance for this show. We're talking inside the world of coding agents. The best versions of these tools feel less like autocomplete and more like a working collaborator. But a collaborator with repo access needs a permissions model that a tired developer can understand.
That's the human part. People make mistakes when they are tired, rushed, curious, or trying to unblock something. A good boundary doesn't assume the user will remember every risky file. It makes the risky path harder to take accidentally and easier to inspect when something goes wrong.
The closing connection I'd make is narrow. Today's lead was about model access at the market and country level. This last item is access at the file level. In both cases, the question isn't only what the model can do. It's what the surrounding system lets the model touch, through whose account, under which rules, and with what trace afterward.
And that may be the practical mood of this weekend's AI news. Capability is still moving, but the more interesting fights are around the surfaces that meter it. Capacity, country gates, proof checkers, water permits, and local files. The model is powerful. The boundary around it decides who experiences that power as help, leverage, risk, or just another cue.
Tomorrow is Monday, June 29th, and the pieces I want pinned down are concrete. Whether the Claude Transfer Station report produces an official Anthropic response, whether anyone publishes more reproducible GLM 5.2 cyber results, and whether the codex-sensitive files issue turns into a product-level exclusion control. Those are the details that would move today's stories from reported pressure to changed behavior. Lenar Kiss.